Welcome to This Week in the Warner Archive Collection, where we discuss our newest releases. I'm George Feltenstein, and I'm proud to be joined by my colleagues, Matt Patterson and D.W. Ferranti. This is a very special Warner Archive podcast with D.W. and Matt hosting a very special guest. So without further ado, I turn the microphone over to D.W.
Okay, welcome to a very special one-off edition of the Warner Archive podcast in which we are talking to the writer Art Tavana about two things that are intertwined, his new book about the legendary rock band Guns N' Roses and the legendary rock and roll movie Pump Up the Volume. With me is Matthew Patterson. And before we get to Art, who's patiently waiting to talk, Matt, how do we know Art?
You know, sometimes when you're a cultural figure like us at the Warner Archive, we have the, you know, luck to, you know, meet all kinds of people, important authors, and one of those happened to be Art. Art has gone on to become one of those people who we would be supposed to be promoting at some point. And so... Dan, that's where we come in now, because nothing has happened to you and I, but Art's now a big deal.
Not even close.
Art's book comes out April 13th from ECW Press. And Art, the name of the book is?
Goodbye, Guns N' Roses.
And evidently, you know, this is not like a rock and roll bio book. This is, well, I'll let you explain.
Yeah, I guess it's not a rock bio for sure. I would not categorize it as that. I think it's just like cultural criticism, I guess. I don't know, like 3-4 years ago, I was just basically given the opportunity to do a rock bio on Guns N' Roses. I just couldn't really do that book because I kept reading all the books that have been written about them, and I just didn't know, like, I didn't think there was anything left to say about the rock and roll history of the band. So what I did was basically like a bizarre alternative literary nonfiction cinema study almost on Guns N' Roses. So every chapter is, and this is only something you guys know, and I don't really want to announce this like to everybody when I like talk about the book, but it's basically a cinema study. So every chapter is a film, and every film is sort of wrapped around the mythology of Guns N' Roses. So there's a chapter on Days of Thunder, there's a chapter on Terminator, there's a John Carpenter films and how they fit into, like, how Escape from New York and Escape from LA like fit into the dystopian LA myth that talking about on Appetite for Destruction. I don't know, it's weird. It's like a film book within the context of rock and roll history, because I think they're more of a filmic band than any other band in history. So that's kind of where it came from.
I find that a very interesting approach, because one of the things that Dan and I like to do, not just on the Warner Archive podcast or cultural artifact, you know, like a song or an album or a movie exists within, you know, this vast interlocking cultural context of the time and place that it came out of, and perhaps... you know, kind of changes the world or perception and that sort of web reverberates through time. And when we were talking about Pump Up the Volume a few podcasts ago, you know, talking about the Blu-ray release, Dan and I were almost like grasping at straws trying to explain why this movie resonated so much with an audience at that time, because 1989 is very, you know, it's not just the end of the 80s and the beginning of the 90s. There's like a, you know, like from like, you know, you could say maybe 93 and going back to like 87. This was a time of change where the future that we know today was being built. And, you know, it's obvious in some ways when you look at something like The Simpsons, right? Because Simpsons kind of came out of the end of the 80s and is still going today. And the internet kind of appeared to a lot of people, it felt like out of nowhere, but all of these movements were happening in this time period, and music was changing as well. And so when Guns N' Roses showed up at the end of the 80s, like big time, it wasn't, you know, to me, it wasn't just hair metal. It was like, and it wasn't just rock and roll. It was like something else, something like almost theatrical about it. And something that you couldn't ignore, but a lot of people couldn't quite explain it or quite come to terms with it. So I love that concept in your book, because all of these like pieces kind of come together to create the tapestry that is our culture and our culture today.
Yeah,
and I mean, talked a lot. Did you
they very much are kind of like the good bad movie equivalent of a band in a weird way. Like I think that's what
yes,
that's what made them so exciting for me. It was like they're absurd, but like a Michael Bay like explosion or like, you know, any one of those Dons, you know, like it's like it makes you feel something, and it's entertaining and it's funny, but it's also beautiful, and like you want more. And I had this debate with someone yesterday about the whole Scorsese sort of debate about content and like his obsession with Fellini and this argument about what is or is not cinema. And that sort of was like, weirdly, that was why I wrote this book, because it was like, what is or is not like a great band? Is right. Guns N' Roses a great rock band? Some people would say no. They say they're silly, you know, this like toxically masculine sort of machismo 80s hair metal band. Some people would say they're the greatest rock band of the last, you know, 30 years. I don't know the answer to that, but like, what was interesting to me is like people always want to decide what is or isn't art. And that was the struggle for me. It's like, is Guns N' Roses art? And so like I spent like 3 years trying to figure that out through movies.
But you also have a bit of, through one of your many writer hats, you also had a previous pretty strong connection with Guns N' Roses.
Yeah, so like the reason I got the book deal actually was by some kind of random coincidence. And I think at this point I'd left Warner Brothers. It was like a few months maybe after leaving Warner Brothers, where I got a call from somebody who told me that they were reuniting and that they were going to like do a show on the Sunset Strip at like midnight on April 1st or something. It was 2016. And I was working at the mall, and I still work at the mall, but I left that job. I called in sick that day and went to the Sunset Strip. And I was the only journalist who like got into that show. So I was the only person that wrote about their reunion show by like a massive coincidence. And so that like went viral. And so all these people started reaching out to me saying, hey, oh my God, you should like write about the reunion. You should do a history of the reunion, follow the band, go on the road. And I said, no, I don't really care about the reunion. I care more about like their past as like an artifact of Americana, you know? And that's where I like took the book.
Wow. Again, combining it with film, that's a really great, fascinating approach, especially since, you know, for those of us who remember speaking like Michael Bay, you know, Guns N' Roses' approach to music videos, yeah, they basically spinal tapped it. They took everything people were doing and turned it up to 11.
Exactly. And you know, they were like, November Rain is to me the first, I mean, it's one of the first times I saw a movie for me where I was just completely like, I zoomed into the TV screen. It like turned my world upside down. It was my first like Michael Bay movie. I was, I think, 9 when it came out. And I remember seeing the premiere on MTV. I was sitting on the floor on my like mom's carpet. And I watched this. It was a movie to me. It wasn't rock and roll or music. So, and it's funny because that, you know, that's actually Donald Trump's favorite music video. Did you guys know?
Like, no, I did not know that.
I found that out in the process of writing the book. So I found this like Sarah Huckabee Sanders biography that she wrote. And in there, she says that Donald Trump would pull her into the Oval Office with Hope Hicks and show them November Rain and say, this is the greatest video ever made. I swear to God, that's like, whether that's true or not, I mean, she said it. I just think it's really funny. And it makes perfect sense if you watch the video.
Right. So now let's narrow in on our own selfish focus. Tell me the first time you saw Pump Up the Volume.
Okay, so the first time I saw Pump Up would have been, and I can't give you like an exact moment, but it would have been the mid-90s on either like Cinemax or Showtime or HBO maybe. I don't know which movie channel had the rights at the time. It's on New Line, so I guess it probably would have been like, I don't know. But that's the first time I saw it. I didn't like it when I initially saw it because the movies that I liked at that point were the John Hughes films. And I love the sort of the musical montages, the sentimentality, the like, you know, the Molly Ringwald sort of like, you know, the person across the tracks crushing on the princess or whatever. Like those are the storylines that I really like cling to. And this to me was like the anti John Hughes film because it was like, there was hip hop and there was like this like, dark, melancholic score. The soundtrack was dark, was punk rock. I mean, it opens with this like you know, it just opens in a way where it makes you feel like downcast, and it's angry, and it's telling you to do something about the problem. It's like, it's an activist film. Whereas the John Hughes films were the complete opposite of activism. They're more like satires of bad parenting almost. And so like,
conservative. I didn't like it at first.
And they they were conservative. Yeah, you're right.
There's a real conservative streak to, I mean, you know, maybe not what we would say politically now, but, you know, John Hughes movies were about fitting in. And something like Pump Up the Volume was like, you know, question authority, right? Which is a kind of a punk rock and roll message. For me personally, my big moment, Pump Up the Volume came out a year after I first saw Guns N' Roses live. I was in high school.
Wow, you saw them live in high school. That's great.
And my friend had a car, and he was like, I love Guns N' Roses. And, you know, I kind of thought they were, like, I identified with their theatricality, and they were opening for, it was like a Monsters of Rock tour. It was Guns N' Roses were opening, and they opened for Deep Purple and Aerosmith. It was, and this was a giant stadium.
I remember
stadium.
That, yeah.
And I'm like, well, we got to get there early because everybody's going to be there for Guns N' Roses. Guns N' Roses is so fantastic. And I got there, and, you know, Guns N' Roses comes out. The light is still shining. It is because it's the summer, probably one of the few times they played during the day. And the stadium is half full, but they shot the Paradise City video there while I was there in the audience, which you don't see that it's mostly empty. But it was so over the top and amazing. Not only to me did they sort of out theatrical, you know, Deep Purple, where some of the people in the audience set fire to the smoke on the water. And Aerosmith, that was when the drummer would come out in this like rotating cage over the audience. But after Guns N' Roses, the crowd rioted and tore down the concession stands on the floor and started throwing hot dogs into the audience. And I'm like, if this isn't like rock and roll, I don't know what is. And I don't think I've ever actually kind of witnessed anything in my life to top that at that theatrical scale. I love it. And so, you know, with Pump Up the Volume, this is about a kid, right? Like who's coming out of high school and he's trying to find his voice. And, you know, and nobody kind of takes him seriously. He has to kind of disguise himself. And then he kind of comes out and he's dangerous. Now that he has a voice, he, like, all of a sudden everybody, you know, kind of turns against him, and he, you know, just has this moment against the government. Like, what he says can bring down society. And like, and that's, you know, I mean, it was an over-the-top movie, but then, you know, so is, like, rock and roll like this. It's, like, theatrical over-the-top, but liberating as well. And so that's why I love that you're doing the book like this, because it's so hard to capture that kind of zeitgeist.
Yeah. And so the reason why this movie is in the book was kind of funny, because so I had to do the Nirvana or grunge chapter, right? You have to eventually, when you do a Guns N' Roses book, you have to get to the point where you try to discuss how did they become uncool. And I was watching this movie by complete coincidence. I was watching this movie and I was like, this is exactly why Guns N' Roses became uncool, because it defines the mood that was like starting, like Samantha Mathis, I think, talked about this recently, where she's like, she did the movie and she's like, I could feel the world was like changing. You could feel like punk rock had gone from like cassette tape, like trading, you know, like Liz Phair and stuff. And suddenly it was like going to be on MTV. Suddenly it was like in magazines and Rolling Stone. And there were movies being made by obscure Canadian filmmakers who were like doing this like Pump Up the Volume movie that made no sense. Didn't even have an ending. I think the original title, it wasn't even the original name, right? It was something else, and they changed it to Pump Up the Volume because that was more like right. Hollywood. That movie defined to me the grunge sentiment better than any movie in 1990, for sure. I mean, Slacker and those movies that came out as well, but like I think for me, the anger and the resentment and the kind of like ridiculous, over-the-top, absurdist nihilism that was connected to like Nirvana and the... Because Nirvana was always funny. They were always trying to be... They were always trying to make fun of it. People don't understand, like, they think they take Kurt Cobain so seriously, but he was like a dark comedian in a lot of ways. And I think, again, that movie, this movie captures that for me, because Hard Harry is like, yeah, sure, he's serious, he's angry, he's pissed off, but he's also kind of just being ridiculous and stupid, right? All this, like,
yeah.
So,
I like what you said on that, and I guess it was like when something is like at the cusp, right? The cusp of breaking through and feels rebellious. When it becomes entrenched, then it just, or becomes mainstream, especially at this time, it becomes defanged, right? It doesn't, it kind of loses its power.
Yeah, and becomes... Because, I mean, as you just relayed, you know, like a previous decade Led Zeppelin concert in Boston ending a riot, you know, metal was something that people were afraid of. But then after when alt went mainstream, metal was suddenly defanged for no fault of its own, and the fad went to grunge, and then that was defanged by hip hop, which defanged itself, and now no one's scared of music. The end.
That's actually so perfect. That is what happened pretty much, yeah.
Well, so how should we terrorize parents today?
I don't know. It's definitely not through music, because we've crossed that. We like parents are doing TikTok videos where they're dancing to Cardi B. So you can't really scare parents with music anymore. I don't know. I think it's like their politics. Like if your parents are liberal and you're not, or if your parents are conservative and you're not, I think that scares parents now more than anything. Or religious. Like if your parents are Catholic and you're a Satanist, I think that might scare parents nowadays. I don't know. It's definitely not music anymore.
Or seeing you read Goodbye Guns N' Roses by Art Tavana.
Or that, yeah, that, well, hopefully. Hopefully that's the reaction.
Which is coming out when, Matthew?
April 13th, I believe. Dan, should...
ECW Press, available on online and offline retailers everywhere.
I think that I should probably buy a copy of this for your child, Dan.
Absolutely. All right. Thank you very much, Art. It's been great seeing you, even though this is on a device. Art was one of the few people who were told they had to work with us. Actually was like, oh, what do you guys do? As opposed to, really? I just figure, you know, maybe we'll let Art take the spotlight. In addition to Pump Up Your Volume, Art, what are some of your favorite rock and roll movies?
Oh, gosh, rock and roll. Almost Famous, for sure. It's probably number one. Anything by Cameron Crowe, I think it changed my life. And I love Cameron Crowe so much. John Hughes movies, they're all rock and roll. I mean, even, you know, Some Kind of Wonderful is rock and roll to me. I mean... Gosh, what are my favorite rock and roll movies? The Doors with Oliver Stone's The Doors. I love that film. I'm actually trying to get in touch with Oliver Stone to interview him about that movie, because that's another movie in my book. That's an important book that I think captures the rock and roll myth, or the ridiculous side of the rock and roll myth. What do you guys think? RoboCop, maybe? I think it's rock and roll in a weird way. But it's the first. It was my first exposure to punk rock. Like when RoboCop shoots that guy in the... rock with his gun or whatever. That was my first exposure to punk rock. So for me, that's rock and roll. I don't know. So
I'm gonna cut Matt off and say Listomania.
But Matt was gonna say that.
He was gonna say that or the Finks.
Oh, the Finks is good. I was gonna say Wild in the Streets because I was doing a rewatch. Because you know what? If you can't give 14-year-olds the right to vote, why even bother?
Yeah. Well, speaking of bothering, Art, thank you so much for calling in and letting us talk about your book and Pump Up the Volume. So, thank you, Art. I'm DW for Auntie.
I'm at MR Matt Patterson on the socials.
All right. And thank you very much.
Cool. Thank you, guys.